Ugh, you were right. It's not subtle.
See?
Well, hello and welcome, everyone.
Okay.
Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 94.
Woo!
In what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series, I'm your host, Aaron Roden.
You don't want to get mixed up with a guy like
and
me.
And this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Welcome. Welcome, new listeners. Welcome to the old listeners. Welcome to the people that just put this on and zone out for about an hour.
Whoa, ass ahoy.
Once a week. Once a week, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in and downloading the show. However you get it, through iTunes, Stitcher, Zune Marketplace, stream it directly from our website or from the new website at CairoRadio.com. Yes, we are on a new network with CBS Radio Seattle and Cairo 97.3. We're super excited about that, so go and check out the new website, CairoRadio.com, and give us some love on there, because like I said in the last episode, episode 93 with comedian Brett Hamill, now, since we're on a network again, our numbers matter.
No, Kelly Clarkson!
And that is totally annoying, to tell you the truth. We have got a great show planned for you today, everybody. Super, super excited that I lined this up. There's a guy by the name of Mark Baumgarten, and he is the editor-at-large for a local monthly free magazine here in Seattle called City Arts, City Arts Magazine. And this guy has done some fabulous, fabulous work in the past. He did an amazing interview with somebody I'm sure most everyone is now familiar with, Mike Daisy. And he took a trip over to the Foxconn factory in Shenzhen, China, and then wrote this little like one-man play about the account of what's going on over there. And some of it came to light a little bit later, that some of it was completely made up and some of it was stolen from other people's accounts of their trips to Foxconn and other facilities like that, where they build like the Apple products and everything. So Mark had this very interesting story that he wrote about Mike Daisy, a great interview, before all that stuff took place. And so we talk about that a little bit, how he felt when all the shit hit the fan, so to speak. So yeah, really interesting guy. So I had a great time talking to him, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, I'd like to tell you guys about something that's going on here in Seattle Monday night at 8 p.m. Did I say that wrong? I did. Monday the 30th of April at 8 o'clock, 8 p.m., Moshe Kasher, comedian Moshe Kasher, is coming to Seattle to the Can-Can for some book signing of his new book called Kasher in the Rye, which you can get out. It's out now in stores. You can check that out. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Moshe Kasher is very funny. If you haven't seen his stand-up yet, I would urge you guys to come out to the Can-Can on Monday night, April 30th. So that is going on. We've been having some fantastic weather. Just to switch gears here for a second, we've been having some fantastic weather the past couple weekends here in Seattle. And the other night, me, Mairead, and my daughter Tatum went out to Whole Foods, went down to the Whole Foods and got some stuff for a picnic. Because Whole Foods has this like big like kind of buffet place, you know, you can get all the good stuff there. And I will say, you know, not always the best food ever, you know, it's very flavorless. You really got to dump some salt on that stuff, some salt and some pepper, because it really just doesn't taste like anything. Yeah. Anyway, that's beside the point. And I was looking at their, I'm a soda guy. I probably drink a little bit too much soda. But I like diet stuff. I like diet stuff. I'm doing this low-carb thing. I want to kind of keep with it, right? And a lot of the stuff that they have, there's all this, like, stevia-flavored stuff, this stevia-flavored colas and everything like that, or sweetened colas, you know. And stevia, if you don't know, if it's this natural, like, leaf that's kind of sweet, but it tastes, it's very chemically, it's very, very weird, you know. And I'm used to your regular diet chemicals, you know, like your Diet Cokes, your Diet Pepsis, your Diet 7-Ups. So that's what my flavor receptors are used to, right? So I'm looking for something other than these sodas that are sweetened by this stevia stuff in the Whole Foods there, and I can't seem to find anything. So I go to one of the guys that works there, and I say, "Hey, bud, is there do you guys have like a Diet Hansen soda or something like that, or just Diet Coke or anything like that?" And he looks up at me, and he kind of you know, gives me this look, and he goes, "No, we don't carry that stuff because I, you know, look, man, it's really bad for you." Okay, first of all, one thing, right? Quit looking down on people who drink diet soda. It's not that bad, okay? It's really not that bad. You may not like it. You may not like the taste of it because of the aspartame or whatever is sweetening that stuff, Splenda, what have you. But other people don't mind it, okay? And if somebody else likes something you don't like, no matter if it's bad for them or not, stay out of it, right? Right? Oh, my God. And second of all, if you're going to say something like that, like it's really bad for you, don't have a pack of cigarettes sticking out of your breast pocket like this douche. Oh, my God. I was so angry. I was so mad. He gave me this look. He was judging me with his eyes, right? And I guess, I don't know, maybe it's karma. Maybe it's karma for how many people I was judging at the zoo yesterday, although this happened, like, way before. Anyway, but yeah, so he told me that aspartame or diet soda is super bad for me, all the while having a, you know, a bright yellow pack of American Spirit cigarettes in his breast pocket. Yeah, dude. Yeah. Real healthy. Real healthy. Whatever. Anyway, that's my little complainy story for the opening segment of this show. We've got a wonderful show for you guys. Let's see. One more thing that's coming up that Mark wanted me to plug in here so you guys know about it. This Tuesday night, which will be, let's see here. It's going to be the 24th of April, 2012. So if you're listening to this in 2014, it's too late. It's too late, guy. Tuesday night at the Sunset Tavern here in Seattle, in the Ballard neighborhood, $3 cover. It's called Work in Progress. Mark is going to read from his new book, Love. Let's see. Let me make sure I just get this right. Right? Yeah. Love Rock Revolution, K Records and the Rise of Independent Music. I'm super excited about this book. This book is coming out on July 10th, and it's going to be super good. We talked to him about it too. So he's going to be reading a little bit from his book on Tuesday night at the Sunset. Also, Damian Jurado is going to be there playing, covering some K Records tunes. So yeah, make sure to check that out. Also, a little bit later on in the show, Mark says his website is markbaumgarten.com. It's actually marksbaumgarten.com, so keep that in mind. All right, let's get to it, shall we? Oh, let's see here. List of songs. We're going to be featuring music today. Everything is going to be off of the K Records roster here. And the first one we're going to hear, one of the bands that I used to love listening to in my teen years. Oh, man, I loved this band. The Halo Benders. This is called Don't Touch My Bikini off of their album God Don't Make No Junk from 1994. Man, this just... Oh, man. This is like a blast from the past.
I hate that saying. I hate it. I hate that saying. Why did I say that? I don't know. I'm so sorry.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Halo Benders, don't touch my bikini. We'll be back in a moment. Keep on walking, need a witness. Keep on talking, skin is feeling, getting rotten. Got a feeling you really started something. Don't touch my bikini. Better smile when you see me. You can stare, that's a freebie. Don't touch my bikini. Welcome back to the Airwave Podcast. That was Don't Touch My Bikini by the Halo Benders off of their 1994 album God Don't Make No Junk, which was on heavy rotation in my Honda Accord back in the day. How about you, man?
Were you a big Halo Benders fan? Yeah, Halo Benders was kind of my... It wasn't the first K Records artist that I heard, but it was... the first one that I really noticed when I got to college heard on college radio. That song, Canned Oxygen, and then Virginia Reel Around the Fountain, which was a few years later. Yeah. But that's a great song. You know that boing noise?
Yeah, that was done with, wasn't it like a reverb box or something like that from an amp?
I think that it was, that might have been it, but it's not on the master.
Oh, it's not?
No. It was, Doug March told me this story about how they finished that song, and then they were, mixing it, and Steve Fisk was the one who was recording it, I think. Uh-huh. And Calvin was like, the song needs something more, and he decided that it needed a boing noise. And so as they were mixing it, and the recording from all the master tracks, Calvin was just sitting there with his finger on the button and just pressing the boing every time.
Nice, nice. Yeah, so it probably wasn't the reverb box. I was remembering something. I think it's a different story for a different something rather.
I think it was Fisk's, synthesizer or something but I don't quite remember what that is.
Well, Mark Baumgarten, did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Did I stutter enough on that one?
No, that's good. You didn't call me Bumgartner. Yeah, anything like
you get that.
That yeah a lot really? I think that's the original because it translates as tree gardener, And my really? Last name translates as tree garden, which doesn't quite make sense for
German. Is it German?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think they got like switched up a little bit on the island. And there are a lot more Baumgartners than there are Baumgartens.
Really?
So, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Enough that when I do run into another one, uh-huh. They like connect with me because we have this shared frustration of everybody thinking that we're Baumgartners instead of Baumgartens.
That you're part of this other family.
Right, right. Yeah, it was actually like I was in security at this little airport in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is near my hometown where I grew mm-hmm. up. And one of the security guys had Baumgarten was his last name, and the whole like security, like it was a big deal to everybody in this very small airport, like all, you know, three members of the TSA were there, and they it was the most informal, joyous moment I've ever had going through airport security. So
treated
me like a brother.
Nice. Yeah. I recently like Googled my name, Aaron Roden.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that there were other Rodens.
Thanks for reminding me what your name is.
Right. that was smooth, wasn't it? Yeah. I saw it written all over your face. But I Googled my name, and I knew that there were other Rodens around, like here in Washington, that I've never met before. But there are quite a few Aaron Rodens out there.
Hmm.
Which was curious to me.
Do you come up top on the Google results?
Yeah, yeah.
That's all that matters,
right? Yeah,
yeah. That's my dad told me that he was very proud of me when
he Googled your name and I took up
like the top 15, I think, before.
Yeah.
I think that there's a tire salesman in Ohio that's like moves a massive amount of tires and has won some regional awards, but
yeah. Yeah, he's Les Schwab's main competitor.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, totally. Wow, this conversation just got real narcissistic, didn't it? Yeah. Well, Mark Baumgarten joining me from City Arts Magazine, among other things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of part-time editor there right now.
Yeah,
right?
I'm editor at large.
Editor at large.
Which
okay.
just means that I
was gonna
don't.
Yeah, I was going
to ask
you
have
that
to
meant.
Be in the office all the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And. I used to be the executive editor there, which meant that I was chained to my desk and didn't get to go out and really report stories as much as assign them, which is great,
right.
And, which I've done for a number of years and really enjoy.
Now, does the editor at the executive editor of mm-hmm. like a weekly, is that a weekly? No, it's a monthly.
It's a monthly,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Free magazine here in Seattle. City Arts Magazine. Now, do you get to decide what stories or like come up with stories for people to do? Or is it just like, you know, reporters come to you and they say, this is what I want to write about?
I mean, it's a little bit of both. Yeah. Ideally, there's a lot of back and forth and people coming in with ideas. You know, it's just like... a lot of it is just getting your staff to continue to like do beat work, like keep in touch with contacts, dig, mm-hmm. keep up on news and just try to find story angles. I mean, it's a very arduous process that
I can imagine, man.
Eventually, like, because the resulting product is ideally filled with, you know, a lot of life and like energy and people telling stories, but the back end of it, as is the back end of any sort of kind of entertainment product or whatever, is mm-hmm. Is filled with just a lot of like sifting through a ton of crap trying to find what those compelling people and stories
are
to put out there. And you know, I mean, so
do,
I was
do you
I was,
like it? It sounds like you might be a little bit tired of it.
Well, I was a little tired of being an assigning editor,
mm-hmm.
and
you wanted to be out there doing the
Stuff like I mean, because you know, I got to the point where it became clear that the smart thing for me to do is that when I knew that there was a story that would demand a lot of time and effort
uh-huh.
in reporting it, that I would hand it off to somebody else because you know the job of the executive editor is just, you know, there's so much other stuff to do and you're just spinning so many plates. So it was like now I one of my favorite things to do. I'm really a narrative storyteller. Like I don't really like to I'm not the person who's going to like synthesize an essay that's going to argue to you like why like neo soul is, you know, a like I don't know, a bad thing, whatever, you know. I'm not going to like try to make sense of culture for anybody or like that's not my strong suit.
You're not a columnist.
No.
Right? That's kind of more of a like a columnist.
Yeah,
duties,
or like a
right?
Yeah, or definitely a columnist,
opinion
commentator,
yeah.
A pundit, whatever. I don't know if a pundit is right, but what I like to do is just put myself into a situation where I'm able to tell a story where I'm going to like witness the story and then all I have to do is in narrative fashion write it and the reader can come to whatever conclusion they want to about the events and people involved.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the first things that I did after I stepped down from that executive editor position was I noticed that there is this former Seattle theatrical person named Mike Daisy who was who was premiering this play down in at the Berkeley Rep and called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs.
Yep. I'm sure everybody knows his
name.
Everybody
knows this now. But back then, like, nobody really knew it. I mean, and he was bringing it up to Seattle Rep, and I just thought, like, I knew that he had a Seattle connection, which is really important to our readership. And then I just, like, thought I was, like, the subject matter. I'd, you know, heard a couple of his monologues and found him really engaging. And I just felt like that's, like, something was going to come about with that story and that I knew that he was starting it out in Berkeley, which he chose because it was close to the Apple campus. And then he was taking it to the to Washington DC and then to Seattle and then to New York after that. And I just had the feeling that like with the path that it was taking and the subject matter and just kind of like the zeitgeist,
like it was
going to
be
stuff,
kind of a snowball effect. And
I think that the way I sold it to the editor is that I said this story is going to be on the cover of the New York Times Sunday magazine in 8 months. Let's put it on our cover now. And so I argued that I wanted to do that, and so I flew down to San Francisco to the Bay Area and went and saw the play and had dinner with Mike like the day after he met with Steve Wozniak, who was like the co-founder of Apple, who went to the play and then wept and all this, you know, stuff. And
did you see that? Did you see him weep?
No, I did not, but okay. I do believe that it happened.
Okay. He's a very emotional person.
Right.
His steak was super good and he cried.
Yes.
He cried.
So I went down there and I put together this story and, man, it was like really, I think the best thing that I have written probably in my life. I was really proud of that story. And so that was a product of me being
able to... Well, it got a lot of attention here in Seattle as well, story did. I remember when it came out. So how did you feel then when kind of the truth was laid out there? That some of the stuff he was taking from other people's accounts and some of the stuff he was just flat out making up.
Yeah, I mean, for those who don't know, right?
Yeah.
Is he, the play involves him. It's a monologue, and it's presented as journalism,
Right.
I mean, yeah. It straight up is.
Yeah, and he says that he went down to the Apple manufacturing plant, which is Foxconn in China. Mm-hmm. And it's not in the Sichuan area.
It's the Shenzhen.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And he says he gets into a car with his interpreter. He goes down to Foxconn. First of all, there's guards that have machine guns in front of the facility and everything
that. Yeah, and he tells a story about meeting, underage workers.
Underage workers, 12
years old. And
mm-hmm. Which he actually still backs up. He says that that was still true.
Yeah, I don't...
Did you hear that interview with him?
But I heard one before that one where he said that he didn't remember, and then all of a sudden he remembers. Yeah. And so... Shit. So anyway... So he said, but then the one thing that he does admit was made up was mm-hmm. that he met with these workers who were poisoned by this gas that's used in the production of these.
Right. Hexane gas.
Yeah. And that there was this old man with a claw for a hand mm-hmm. That got crushed in a machine. And it's really the emotional, like, high point of the play.
Totally.
And then
he hands him his iPad and
and it's great.
He's never seen one on, and he calls it some type of magic. Right?
Yes.
Like some type of magic.
Oh, yes. And yeah. It was, I mean, I think that I shed a tear at that moment, or I at least got really misty, mm-hmm. which I tend to do. But, anyway, so, it comes out that, that they find out, This American Life puts him on the show and, then they find out by getting a hold of his interpreter that there was no underage workers, there was no hexane gas mm-hmm. poisoned mm-hmm. people, there was no man with a hook hand, claw hand. And so anyway, so when that came out, man. Yeah, I read it. And I really didn't want to believe it. Really was, because I felt some
attachment. You had some sort of attachment to the story, right?
I mean, you put in
a lot of work to this.
Right. My initial thing was not necessarily about the work that I put in. It was that, one of the reasons why I was attracted to telling the story was because it was, something that I felt was brave,
right. Yeah.
And actually within my story I go into the realm of talking about how and this is where I feel like if I could go back, I wish I could go back and approach this in a different manner, but I really took Mike for his word that this was a sort of journalism.
Right, right.
And I really believed him when he said that, that it was ridiculous that nobody else was telling this story because it's right out there in front of their eyes and none of these other, institutions uh-huh. are doing this story. And really discredited journalism. And I kind of, bought into that, and that was a mistake, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I think that
did that put you in a bad place, like mentally?
It still is messing with me. I mean,
really?
I still don't quite know how to think about, because this is the thing, is that what I just told you is that mm-hmm. like I'm a guy who likes to tell a narrative story, which means that in order to do that, you really have to open yourself up and trust everybody who's around you and just tell people what you see and what you witness. And so I did that with Mike Daisy, and then I ended up just spreading lies. And because I wasn't like a journalist who was obsessed with like pulling apart every claim,
uh-huh.
I ended uh-huh. up just, spreading lies unintentionally, which is really the opposite of what I want to do.
Well, and I think a lot of journalists feel that way as well that did stories on that. I mean, This American Life devoted a whole episode to the retraction of that and actually going in and digging
too.
It was totally good. Yeah. But I think, you know, what struck me as surprising, and I guess this is why I'm on the fake radio. I'm a pseudo journalist, I guess. Well, no, I'm not. Okay, I'm not even gonna say that. I'm not a journalist. But like, I didn't get why people, you know, took it so personally, I guess, you know.
Well, I took it personally. Like, so there was that first instance, which was very much just a moment of me looking at the way that I approach my craft.
Right, right.
You know, and then I went back and read the story that I wrote.
Uh-huh.
And like, at the same time, I'm like, every time I read something that I knew had been revealed that
yeah.
was untrue,
and now you're
I was
going
like,
back
ugh.
And you're going, God, why didn't I check
I know.
That?
But then,
at
the same time, I'm just like, oh, this story is so good.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm like, ah.
But everybody got duped. Like, that's my point.
Right.
Like, he duped everyone.
Right. But, and this is the thing, is that what I realized is that I wasn't just, like, repeating a lie that he told the audience. Mm-hmm. And this is where I really take issue with him saying that this is a piece of theater.
Right.
And that his only mistake was in putting it in the context of journalism, which is what This American Life
yes.
did to the story.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember him saying that, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, he told me, I mean, and I wrote like a column about this, but he, you know, he said like, it's not that hard. Like, journalists just need to do this and this and this, and they'll discover this. And he's actually, like, telling this to me while we're sitting and eating, like in a Vietnamese restaurant, like,
yeah, yeah,
having dinner. And he was lying to me. He's, like, sitting there looking at me in the face, and he's lying to me. And that's when I read through my story, I realized that it wasn't just from the stage that he was lying to me, is that he actually was lying.
He lied to you
straight to
face.
My face.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, there's another aspect of the production, which is that when the audience walks out of into the lobby, the staff of the theater, they're handing out these, you know, sheets of paper that say, you know, are you disturbed by what you heard? Here's what you can do. And they like,
yeah, yeah.
And they give all this information about contacting Apple and telling them to stop doing this practice and like contact all these other
mm-hmm.
Do
you think he believed his own bullshit?
Yeah, I think so. But this is the thing, is that
okay,
like,
yeah.
you can't claim that it is, you can't claim that it's art when you are telling people to go out and do real world activism based on fabricated information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like your fourth wall, like I'm all about breaking the fourth wall, but like, the only way that works as art is if he is just like screwing with the audience,
right?
You know,
right.
And like that is the only way that you could say that that's art. And I don't think that that's what he's doing, because I know that what he believes he's doing is right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The problem is that he thinks that he has a monopoly on what is right, and who is he to decide what is right?
Huh.
You know, and that's sort
yeah.
of where.
Yeah. Back to like City Arts, you did this story for City Arts. You
yeah, I mean,
this.
So
this
was,
is what you really wanted to do,
right? This is what I really wanted to do. So I didn't
yeah,
like
yeah.
So naturally, we had to devolve into that part of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, the really sad thing about it for me is that, you know, I've pulled that story from my like. From my website where I have
oh,
all of my favorite
yeah.
stories, and that used to be like
yeah.
top billing, and if anybody wanted to know
you
like,
can't put that down on
no,
your curriculum.
No, I don't. I mean, I just had
oh,
to pull it
geez.
Down and but it is an example of the what I can do now. And I guess
uh-huh.
that like the way that it fits in is that this world of being sort of a full-time storyteller instead of an editor is new to me.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so what I've like, that's one of the things in the last year where I have learned a lesson.
Yeah.
Which is don't believe everything that people tell you, which is a lesson that I think that my parents tried to teach me when I was 12, but it took me a long time to finally come around to it. So
what did you, what was the start of you, loving to write? Did this start way back when you were a kid, or did it happen in like later on in life?
I mean, I used to write funny, like humorous stories for my friends when I was in junior high and high school, but I didn't really think that there was much to that. You know, the first thing that I ever had published was when I was 18, and I was home. I grew up in this small farm town in Wisconsin named Toma. And I went to school at University of Minnesota, and I came back home for the first summer after my freshman year to paint houses with my buddy Tom. And
great college job, right there.
Yeah, it was fantastic, man. We listened to LL Cool J and like get our calves really tan. It was great. And
gotta have tan calves. Gotta have them. Yeah.
I was. The local newspaper is the Toma Journal. It's a twice weekly paper. And the editor there wrote this opinions piece about Republican representative who was on a radio show and was willing to listen to this caller that called in and wanted to talk about UFOs, right? It's a very strange thing to write about. But the editor, his piece was about how like absurd it was that this representative was willing to listen to somebody talk about UFOs, but wasn't willing to talk to gun control advocates about like the necessity for gun control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, despite the fact that I'm little hippy dippy, I've got the long hair and everything.
I wasn't gonna say anything.
I'm very much a person who believes in the conversation. So I was really disturbed by the fact that he was creating this sort of like false equivalency and sort of like using the UFOs as a straw man to kind of like knock down. And so I wrote this letter to the paper, sort of defending this Republican representative against the editor of the newspaper, which is kind of, anybody who knows me now would like think that that's quite counter to like I think that people would believe that I would defend the journalist against the Republican instead of so I wrote this thing and sent it in, and they like it was like the main opinion piece, and they like had me come in, they took my photo and all this stuff, and that was the first time that I ever had anything published. And it was, liberating in the sense that, I was able to, I don't know, that people like somebody was listening to me.
You know,
totally. And that was the main thing, is just that somebody was listening to me. And, I didn't really like get into, being like I don't know, like for a while I thought that.
What year in college were you?
I was a freshman.
You're a freshman. Yeah. So you hadn't picked a major yet. This was
I was like I was a theater major at that point.
Oh buddy.
Oh yeah, I know, it's horrible.
You're such a hippie. but so did this kind of steer you in that direction? I mean, once you saw your name in the paper, you see your picture, you read your own writing in there and stuff, and your parents were probably elated at that fact.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it would, you know, that probably was like, well, let's take a writing class now, right?
Yeah, and that, I mean, it was pretty much, I had one more, semester of
theta,
of being a theater major, and then I moved into being an English lit major, and then I picked up a journalism double after that. And
You write for the school paper or something?
I did, and I also worked for a parenting magazine.
Really?
Yeah, that was my first paying
job. How old were you at this point?
20.
20 and you're working for a parenting magazine? Yes. What are you writing about?
I was writing about the Twin Cities area's greatest martial arts classes for children, baby clothing boutiques.
All right. You became, did you become a connoisseur of this kind of stuff? I mean,
I became a bullshitter of this kind of stuff, I think, is the...
man.
Yeah, it was very instructive in writing outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess, you know, something like that, too, and this is for every field that you get into, too, is like something that is a job where it's making you do something that you're not comfortable with. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's... Yeah, and it makes you a better writer, makes you a better well-rounded employee, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that it made it so that I was very determined. I had the confidence that I could do work that I wasn't really completely about my self identity, but I really knew that I wanted to do something that I cared about. And I think that one of the lessons that I came out of that job with was that I really wanted to spend my time as a writer working on communicating with a community that I felt like I understood and felt like I was a part of, you know, and the Twin Cities parenting community was not what I was not a community that I was a part of at the time. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So that's how you kind of got your start and got into your first magazine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, but I was still working at the college newspaper at the time. And then, there's a whole other story with that parenting magazine that maybe we won't go off on that tangent quite yet. We might come back to that.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to talk with you about how you ended up in Seattle. And then, of course, about this this book that's going to be coming out in July. Is it predominantly about K Records or just about the independent music scene in general?
It's all about K Records, but it's presented with the context of the musical underground that emerged in the 80s.
So, okay, okay. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. All right, we'll be right back with more from Mark Baumgarten. And we're going to go, we are featuring music today, all from K Records. And the next one we're going to go with, let's do this. Madagascar by Lake off of Let's Build a Roof from 2009. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ear holes. Stay tuned. What kind of sound does it make? It'll rattle if you shake it around. All right, we are back, joined here in Dining Room Studios with Mark Baumgarten, the author of the upcoming book, Love Rock Revolution, K Records and the Rise of Independent Music, and also the editor-at-large at City Arts Magazine. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks.
How was your bathroom break?
That was very
refreshing.
Nice. It was nice.
Good.
You have a small child trapped back there.
Yeah. We keep her in a cage in the back room when we do shows. So, you know, Mairead's back there tending to her, poking her with a stick, making her angry for the battle that's going to go on later tonight. that's not really going to happen. I'm sorry. That was a bad joke. Baby fights. That's just bad. Well, welcome back, everybody. That song you just heard was what did we go with? Madagascar by Lake. Off of their album Let's Build a Roof from 2009. And you're a fan of Lake, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, they're my favorite, probably my favorite band on the current roster for, for K. So.
Yeah, I was looking through it because I hadn't really listened to a lot of K Records music in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, my go-tos were Halo Benders and the old Beck album that came out on K.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff, Beat Happening, you know, all the stuff that was back in the early 90s, late 80s,
right.
I was really into. And then I kind of just lost touch with it. So going back through the roster and finding stuff to play for this episode was kind of a lot of fun.
Yeah, but I mean, and that's the same experience that I had is that I didn't come into telling the story mm-hmm. knowing the entire catalog. You know, I mean, I, like you, I had
going on for so long, way you could, you know, unless you were working there or just like a diehard fan.
And even the people who work there don't, I mean, you know, probably don't know everything.
Yeah.
And so it was a process of discovery, you know, digging up all these old recordings of songs mm-hmm. that I'd never heard before they're great.
Were you always a big music fan?
Yeah. I mean, that was sort of my identity when I was a kid. That I was the kid who listened to weird music, you know, and got picked on for it.
Right. I can just imagine, you know, growing up in a small town like that, because we kind of got that in common.
Yeah.
Like when you're into like, you know, quote unquote indie bands back then, or Nirvana, or, you know, your Pearl Jam or whatever.
Yeah. Like really, really bad. Well, not bad, but I was like, Dead Kennedys.
Oh, yeah.
Huge Dead Milkmen fan.
Dead Milkmen. I was just going to bring that one up.
Possum Dixon was like a big band. Do you remember them at all?
No.
No. They were sort of like... So it was... Anyway. That's
we
kind
could
of
just
a whole,
get into
we,
this.
We could get into yeah, this. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear this.
I love it.
But...
So let's get to your book here. When did the idea for this book come up then?
Well...
When did you start... thinking about you wanted to write a book, for lack of a better term.
Well, I mean, I always thought that like writing a book would be a great capstone to mm-hmm. my music journalism career, and I like so I've always kind of been trying to like looking beyond just music, which I know sounds like I don't care about it, but I care about it deeply. I just really...
We all know what your real wish is that you want to write about brushed nickel silverware.
I do. Yeah. And I want to write, you know, Twilight fan fiction or whatever.
hey, you could make millions on that, man.
I know, I hear. Yeah. What was the question?
When did you come up with the idea for the book? Did somebody come to you about it, like
you? Or? Somebody came to me, a acquisitions editor mm-hmm. for Sasquatch Books, which is a Seattle-based publisher who has done like a few music books, but wanted to start growing that part of the company more and get more titles. And so... this woman, Whitney Ricketts, who was the acquisitions editor, came to me and she said, you know, we want to start doing more music books and I like your writing. You should put together a few abstracts and I'll tell you if any of them look good, and then you can, I'll help you develop them into proposals.
Were you nervous at all when somebody said, hey, do you want to write a book?
No, I was really excited because, I mean, I'm sort of like, and, you know, my girlfriend will tell you this, is that when there is a task that I have been privileged to undertake, like, say, I find a door at Earthwise in Soto that will fit in the giant door jamb of my office, I must finish that task as soon as possible. Like, I'm just like very much like always want to prove to myself that I can do the thing that that I've never done before.
That is the complete opposite of what I am. Because I bought a one of those roll up screen doors that is supposed to go on the door that you came through.
Oh, I didn't see it.
You came into Dining Room Studios. Well, that's because I opened the door for you and let you go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's sitting in this giant box now. I bought that a year and a half ago. It's still in a box at the bottom of the stairs, waiting to be set up.
So, well, so, I mean, the, and I don't know how much of an analogy that, I'm just like, I'm a doer.
Right,
because,
right.
And I just want to, and so if somebody says, if you write a book, we'll print up thousands of copies and make an ebook out of it and, like, you know, and send it out into the world.
Yeah.
And just kind of like, well, yeah, like, let me add it. I want to see if I can do that thing.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, so Whitney and I talked a little bit and, I had a few ideas about things that I'd been curious about.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few stories, about Northwest music that I felt hadn't been told that I really, as a person, when I moved to the Northwest, who was doing a lot of research and really, like, already loved a lot of the bands that were out here, wanted to know these stories.
Like what? There's, like, give me an example of one of the one
I
of the
really, like,
that
wanted to... One of the ideas I had was that I wanted to... I pitched a book about Elliott Smith with a focus on his Portland days.
Yeah.
Which there is a book out called Big Nothing, which is really focused on his New York and LA days,
mm-hmm.
with kind of like sort of, you know, gives a little bit of lip service to his youth. But I know from just like talking to people who were, you know, his fellow musicians and knew him when I was in Portland, that there is like, there's a very rich story about his life as a Portlander.
Yeah.
And so, so that was one, like, I like wanted to do sort of this more investigative,
but how, okay. Alex so Smith how did, bio. How did you land? How did you land on the K Records?
Well, the K Records one was actually one that, that Whitney brought up and she's like, what about K Records? And
cause they are kind of like K Records is legendary around Washington
but there is no story. Like, there's story. And that's the, when I was in Portland and just like, you know, trying to get my hands around what this, like regional music culture was, you know, there was tons of stuff about grunge. I didn't need to know anything more about grunge.
Yeah. There's, but it's, there, but it's there, been done.
Yeah. But there was, you know, so much like, there was so much music and artists who were related to K, and then Kill Rock Stars, which is related to K.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like this whole sort of, you know, world out there, and there's no, there's no master narrative of where that came from, how it came about. There's the, Our Band Could Be Your Life, which has a chapter about a beat happening that touches on the origins of K, but there's really like not that primary story. And so that's something that so she's the one that mentioned it, but as soon as she mentioned it, I was just like, that's a story that I'd love to tell. Yeah. And I think that I won her over just in that meeting where I was just like, these are the things that I want to know about that story.
Uh-huh.
And just talked about some of like the mythology surrounding the label.
Yeah.
And,
well, so many people started with, and I guess we can talk about this a little bit because some of the listeners to this program probably have never heard of K Records.
Right.
And like, you know, people or artists like Beck, got their start with K Records.
Right.
I mean, the first, was that the first thing that he had released, you know?
No.
I don't think it is, right?
He had released...
Early recordings, though.
It was recorded prior to the recording sessions, which he did in Olympia at Dub Narcotic Studios, which is the house studio for K Records.
Right. Named after one of Calvin Johnson's other bands, right?
Well, the band is named after the studio.
Oh, it is?
So you should read the book.
Well, it's not out yet. It comes out in July.
Yeah. But let's see. So Loser came out as a single and was getting a lot of play on like what at the time was alternative radio. And after that single came out was when Beck came to Olympia, even though, so he had signed a record label, a deal with Geffen, right? But he stipulated within the deal, and he was, as far as I can tell, the first artist to really like do this, that he could do work with other labels. Like he signed like a 3-record deal to Geffen, but like within the deal was written that he could do one-offs with minor independent labels,
really?
And Geffen wouldn't have a right to it.
No kidding.
Like that's what there was a huge bidding war around him at the time, and that's what he got out of it.
Yeah.
And so therefore he was able to go to Olympia and record this super lo-fi record with Calvin Johnson.
And that's how it kind of started too. Like everything on K back in the, back in early 90s, early 90s, late 80s was super lo-fi, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, bare bones kind of studio, or at least just like kind of older analog equipment.
Oh, I mean, not even that, man. Like the earliest stuff, which you know,
4-track.
Not even that. Like
what?
Panasonic like slab tape recorder was is artist Rich Jensen, who was still an artist in Seattle, but he and Calvin put together one of the first K tapes, because it was started out as a cassette label, where they would put out these cassettes and they'd just like they would actually get the cassettes in bulk from this company that created them for church music, and then they would ship them down to Portland, where the drummer in this band, the Neo Boys, which is this like great all girl band from Portland.
I recognize that name.
Yeah, she would just duplicate them in double like the boombox double deck thing, and she like one at a time at real time speed.
Takes so long. Oh my god.
I know.
I remember doing that as a kid, and it already just like with like 2 songs, it would take forever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, you really have to have a process.
Well, see, what I would do was I would listen to the radio, and then when I heard that my favorite song was coming up, like I'd be downstairs, right, and I'd have to run upstairs and get ready for that song to play because I wanted it on tape.
Right, right.
So while I mowed my parents' lawn, I could listen to, you know, Bitch and Camaro or something like that, you know.
Right.
Which probably wasn't on the radio, actually. But,
yeah. I did that with Cyndi Lauper at the American Music Awards.
Yeah.
Doing Good Enough in, like, 86 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because... you know, that song was on Goonies, and I was like, I love that song.
Yeah,
anyway,
my dad grew up in Astoria, Oregon, where that was filmed, and he knew the house.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I always wonder where the house is. Is it still there?
He knows all the places that they were. It was great, because as kids, we'd go and visit Astoria, and he'd point it all out. It's awesome.
Super dad.
Yeah, yeah. Great guy.
So anyway, where are we going? Oh, so, you know, but there is something really interesting in what we were just talking about in, like, cassette culture. And cassette culture is, like, a really big part of what made K possible.
Uh-huh.
Because starting out as a cassette label, it was that transfer of information, the information being the music, that was so easy that would allowed you to like pull something off the radio and replay it that didn't exist before.
Yeah.
And the fact that like Calvin Johnson, who's the guy who started K Records, you know, had that technology at his disposal is the only reason why that label happened. If he would have lived 5 years earlier, like, I don't know, who knows what would happen.
Yeah, totally.
It was very much about like coming of age and creative maturity at a time where there was the mechanisms, the technological mechanisms to actually like spread a message an audience.
Yeah.
So
well, and it was during a time of angst too, right? Like teen angst was at a all-time high.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think.
You know? He you know, one of the story, like the most interesting thing about this that I learned in writing the book is because I sat down and interviewed Calvin you know, a good number of times. I mean, I probably got like 12 hours with him or something.
Were you nervous
like
when you first met the guy?
Oh yeah, man. He's just like the most it's just nerve-wracking talking to him because he's a very deadpan, you know, like
super baritone voice too, right?
Yeah, he's not expressive at all. You don't know if he
even in conversation.
Oh yeah, yeah,
really?
Yeah. And because it was the first time that I interviewed him, I sat down, we met up at Lighthouse Coffee in Fremont. And well, actually, so let's rewind a little bit. So I the publishing company gave me the green light on the book, and I decided that I would only do it if Calvin was going to talk to me,
right?
Because I hadn't like talked to him about this, and I'm not and I'm not going to like, you know, some of my friends are just like, oh well, you can like stitch something together. I'm like, no, no, that's not, that's no good.
Who am I, Mike Daisy? Come on, no.
And so, so I call up the K Records offices and ask for Calvin. I've interviewed Calvin a couple times before, but I don't really have a relationship with him or anything. And so I call him up and I say, hey Calvin, this is Mark. I've talked to you a couple times before and I'm calling to tell you that I am, so I think I'm going to be writing a book about K Records, where I want to interview all of these people who were involved in the history of K Records and stitch together a history of your record label. And there's a long pause. He goes, that sounds like a boring book. And then I'm like, oh no, I think it'll be like, I think it would be really, really interesting. I think there's some, I just know that there's some great stories that people need to hear. He's like, yeah, I don't know anybody who would read that book. And I was like, yeah, okay, well, you think about it and I'll email you in the next couple of weeks and, you know, let me know if you're interested.
What were you thinking at this point, too? You were just like, that. Shit.
I'm like, oh, man, what am I? I have no idea what I'm doing. You know, like I didn't think that I, I just thought that I was just like way out of my depth.
Yeah.
And, but at the same time, you know, so I emailed with him after that, and he agreed to meet up with me. So we meet up at Lighthouse, and I show up, he's there, and we're both wearing the exact same thing. We're both wearing, like, black shoes, and not that it's, like, a very specialized outfit, but we're both wearing black shoes, straight-legged blue jeans, and black button-up shirts. Like rolled up to the elbow, and we're just like wearing the exact same outfit. We look like we're like soldiers in some sort of, I don't know,
independent music army,
right? So I sit down with him and I start babbling incoherently, and I'm just talking to him about how I like what my approach for the book is going to be and who I want talk to and why I want to do it and blah 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 blah. And and then eventually I just get around to my first question is, what was the biggest difference between the 80s and the 90s?
Yeah,
like that's where I wanted to start. And then there's silence. And he's staring, he's like making a triangle out of his hands, and he's staring down into the triangle. And then he looks up and he looks out the window. And then he looks over, like right over my shoulder. And I just think that he's going to get up and leave.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm like it's, there's time passing, and I'm just really, and then he goes, well, I think the biggest difference between the 80s and the 90s was that in the 80s, the underground didn't have anything to do with the mainstream. And in the 90s, the point of the underground became to become the mainstream.
Right.
Something to that effect. It's in, it's in the book. I don't remember. once I wrote it down, I just forgot about it.
Yeah.
But his point was just that, like, you know, in 1985, there was like, if you were a musician who was making music in Olympia or Seattle, there was like there was Huey Lewis, and then there was you, and there was like no way that you were ever going to meet Huey Lewis, you know? And that, for some reason, Huey Lewis is the example that Calvin uses all the time, which I think is hilarious. And then in the 90s, all of a sudden it became like there was a legitimate pathway between those two things. And that was the path that musicians were sort of kind of expected to take. And at this point, there's like, it's all level now, right?
Yeah. And so, that's when Beat Happening opened up for Huey Lewis and the News.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be a really interesting show.
Yeah. So, Mark, when does the book come out?
It comes out July 10th.
July 10th.
Yes. And it will be available at all discerning bookstores and online and everything like that. So.
Yeah, because you said earlier it was just going to be a web book. Was it originally planned just to be a web book or what?
No. It's definitely like full, like, you know,
awesome.
I mean, it's a trade paperback, so it's not coming out in hardcover or anything like that. And I don't think that it's going to be on in Oprah's book club. Is that a thing anymore? I don't know. I think.
I don't think she has. Does she? She probably does, man.
She still has.
Yeah,
to have,
she still owns half down, of the planet. Right? So yeah.
So
yeah,
I totally don't think that it's going to be on Oprah's book club. But,
well, I'm excited for it, man, because it sounds really interesting. And meeting those guys, meeting Calvin Johnson and getting to talk with that guy and experience that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Like it was totally a lifetime experience right there.
Yeah. I mean, and everybody who's, you know, and the other people that, I mean, I talked to Ian MacKay from, you know, Minor Threat, Fugazi, who has a connection with K, like that whole thing is really super interesting. And just like all of the other artists that I spoke with, you know, everybody really, it's been around for 30 years. So, you know, the memory kind of does tricks on you. So I don't think that everybody clearly didn't remember things in the same way.
Right.
But everybody felt very, everybody has a great affection for what happened.
Yeah. And it's all positive.
Well, but it wasn't all positive.
Oh, okay.
And I think that that's really one of the things that the book does a good job of, is that it really shows, and this goes back to what I was talking about in the beginning, is that I really set out not to try to make sense of this thing, but really just to kind of show the best I could what happened in a sort of like narrative style. And so you really get to see what happens when a man lets his ideology sort of form this world around him, brings people in, they create a community, and then things get complicated. Because things get complicated when you have a community.
Yeah.
And things dissolve and they build up, and you know, and there's really a real life drama that goes around with this record label. And, you know, when I tell people that the book is about a record label, I can see their eyes kind of get a little glassy. and I know that it sounds like a record label doesn't sound like it has much life to it.
Yeah,
but the thing that I'm really proud of is that I think that that I was able to find the drama within the culture that was created around this record label.
Well, it's always been something that I've been fascinated with. And I don't know why. I you know, maybe it was my teenage lust for being a rock star, you know, that still kind of, you know, remains in my psyche a little
bit.
Right,
and the fact that listening to Beat Happening songs, you're just, you know, it's that reaction where it's like, I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the reaction that so many people had and actually turned Olympia into an underground music mecca for a few years.
Yeah, totally. Well, Mark, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on my little fake radio show.
Oh,
I
this
really
isn't fake
it.
At all. It's very real. No, it's a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And so where, let's pimp your wares here a little bit. Where can we find out more about you, about City Arts?
City Arts, you can find more about City Arts at cityartsonline.com.
Okay.
My author website is markbaumgarten.com.
And we'll link to that on our page,
cool.
too. Yeah, so and just then, go to our website.
Right, and then you can learn more about the book by going to loverockrev.com or just searching my name or the book's name at any online sales point or whatever.
And it'll be available July 10th?
July 10th, yeah.
July 10th. All right. Excellent, cool. man. Thank you so much. And you remember, you can find us at air-raid.net or on the all-new cairoradio.com. Go and, check out the new website. It's fantastic. You got all your TBTLs there, your mixtapes, your Dave Ross, your Dory Monson, all that good stuff. So go and check out that fantastic website. Also, please remember to go to iTunes and rate and review the show because it helps us in continuing to get great guests like Mark on the show. So do us a solid. We're going to go out today. Let's see. Another song from K Records. This is All Girl Summer Fun Band off the self-titled album from 2002. This is Video Game Heart, and we will see you next week. Have a good one, everybody.